Welcome to the podcast component of ArmageddonLetters.com, a virtual time machine back to the moment the world was nearly destroyed in late October 1962. You can also follow us on Twitter at ArmageddonTweet. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. The Cuban Missile Crisis happened 50 years ago. It was our closest brush to nuclear war. We want to take you tonight back to about 6 weeks before the really peak period when the world knew that they were in a nuclear crisis. Right now, things are sort of going along. People are not particularly fearful about anything like that, but things are starting to happen.
Cuba has reasserted itself over the summer of 1962 into the bag of foreign policy dilemmas that the president has to deal with, President John F. Kennedy. The previous year had begun with a big bang around Cuba with the Bay of Pigs, but that sort of dropped off the table because Berlin came in. They built a wall in Berlin. Southeast Asia was a big problem in Laos and Vietnam. And of course, anywhere that there were struggles in the Third World, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were peeking over the shoulder of their proxies. But now, the summer of 1962, something quite extraordinary is going on. The Soviets have undertaken the largest movement of military men and material in peacetime in the history of the world. They are transporting thousands of troops, hundreds of weapons, untold quantities of structural material, concrete, wood, anything to build protection for the weapons that they're delivering.
And let's just say part of this rationale for this does not come just out of the blue. In 1961, the U.S. was a background player in an abortive invasion of the island of Cuba by Cuban exiles. And since that time, there have been CIA-sponsored covert operations. So it is not, as far as if you're living in Cuba, if you're the government of Cuba, if you're a citizen in Cuba, it does not feel like peacetime. It feels like the Yankees are rattling the saber, they're blowing up some factories and that kind of stuff. And basically, they're thinking it's a matter of time before an invasion comes to destroy the Cuban Revolution and change the government. They appeal to the Soviet Union, their communist friends, and Khrushchev is looking at the same things that Fidel is looking at, and he sees that's a reasonable request. If we want to keep this amazingly important political and strategic hold of a socialist island in a capitalist hemisphere, we better do something about it. And so the big military buildup begins.
You know, back in the Soviet times, they used to say that the Soviets were poor at innovation. They didn't invent many things or create many things, but once they got their machine wound up, they could turn out stuff like nobody else could, whether it was tractors or cars or missiles. CIA U-2 pilots are taking pictures at way up in the stratosphere at 80,000 feet, and these pictures show an amazing buildup on the island.
They're also receiving intelligence from Cuban exiles who've infiltrated the island and are giving on-the-ground information. Reports are pouring in about lots of things of a military nature arriving in Cuba. And the Republican wing of the Congress in the U.S. is,
along with a lot of Democrats,
they're going nuts. Kennedy, what are you doing?
And the answer they give is nothing. They're taking pictures. They're noting this and they're noting that. Now, Kennedy, he's in a box here because the midterm elections are coming up first week of November. His brother is running for the Senate, Edward Kennedy, in Massachusetts for the very first time. This is a president who got quite a bit fewer than 50% of the popular vote in the 1960 election. He is having some problems. Now, foreign policy is his favorite area. He looks after that himself. What I think really happens here is that, you know, presidents are like the rest of us. They hope for things, and they wish that things won't turn out as badly as it looks like they're going to, and this is one of those situations. Kennedy, in late August receives a report from the CIA. That's on August 29th. And this one is harder to take than all the previous ones because it turns out that the Soviet Union is moving surface-to-air missile systems into the northern tier of the island at various locations. Now, these SAMs, surface-to-air, SAMs, as they're called, the SAM missile sites are going up. These aren't missiles in the sense of ground-to-ground missiles that are launched against targets in a country. These are surface-to-air missiles, meaning they are to shoot down things, mainly airplanes, of course. And the question arises, why are they doing this? What are they protecting? These missiles just sit there unless something tries to wreak havoc with it. And so the conclusion that the CIA provides is only a probable one, and that is, Mr. President, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but probably they are thinking of moving surface-to-surface missiles, also known as nuclear missiles, also known as strategic missiles, and in the code that Khrushchev and Kennedy communicate in at this time, these are offensive weapons meant to target cities and military bases in the United States of America from the island of Cuba.
And also, by the way, offensive weapons are also psychologically
offensive.
And so Kennedy, he doesn't really want to hear this.
He doesn't
want to believe it. And he has basically three reasons. One is he really doesn't want to hear it because it would be an amazing political mess if he sort of bought into this thing. Secondly, the Soviets have never done anything remotely like this. They've never moved nuclear missiles off their own territory. So this is such a stretch. I mean, they haven't put them into Eastern Europe, which is close.
Door.
You know, why would they ever do something so provocative in the backyard of the U.S., where the U.S. owns the hemisphere except for this island? It's so bizarre.
That's the view that
Kennedy says, you know, Khrushchev would not be that stupid to do it. He's a sensible.
He'll know that we have to.
He'll know that
we
will
them.
Go nuts.
Yeah.
And the third reason, which becomes very, very important in mid to late October, is that Kennedy is hearing from the Soviet Union on many levels, we would never do such a thing. So, for example, the day after he gets the CIA report, he's also aware, because they're monitoring lots of things. Let me just give you the headline from Revolution, the main newspaper in Havana. And the headline is, Radio Moscow denies unfounded rumors of Soviet troops in Cuba, and they deny a lot of other things.
This is a major league lie, because now we know that within very few weeks of this particular untruth, that they will have 43,000 troops and military technicians on the island of Cuba. That's
which the CIA will never discover. The CIA's biggest estimate will be 5,000 to 6,000.
Right.
Kennedy's getting these denials, but at the same time he's getting denials, he's also confronting calls for action. And so you have, for example, and again, the Cubans are paying attention to this. They are reporting this. Another headline or story in Revolution, this one on September 3rd, 1962, is they report that Senator Strom Thurmond, who at that time was a Democrat in Congress, is calling for a direct attack against Cuba right now. What in heaven's name is Kennedy waiting for?
Right.
This is the context in which Kennedy is maneuvering. And so on September 4th, 1962, a very important date to remember,
Kennedy digs
does
a hole
two
for
things. First, there's a private meeting.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy, Bobby, the Attorney General, the President's younger brother, goes to the Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin and tells him in no uncertain terms that offensive weapon systems in Cuba are not going to be tolerated. They shouldn't even think about this. This is code, again, for strategic nuclear weapons. That if any are found there, he should assume that the United States will take them out there. They have no choice. They are on record. There's no way that this is going to play well. Debrinin, we now know, didn't know what was going on in Cuba. Khrushchev thought it was a good idea to lie to his own foreign service because they would lie a lot better if they thought they were telling the truth. Now, that's a hell of a way to conduct foreign policy, but this is actually what happened.
So Debrinin is actually quite convincing. And this yep. is a private channel, really at the highest level. You've got Khrushchev's highest person in the U.S., Anatoly Debrinin, who has...
He's brilliant and very trusted.
He's very affable. We've got to know Anatoly very well. He certainly was a very good spokesperson for his government, a good servant to his government, but he's also amazingly personable. He was liked and trusted by U.S. political figures who got to know him. So he says this to Bobby Kennedy. Well, he's saying it to the president's brother. So he...
Who, needless to say, is a credible messenger from the
from
president.
The president and will be a credible messenger back to the president.
Right.
So this is a conversation at the highest level, with the highest level of credibility that Kennedy gets, with the message that he wants to hear.
Yep.
So surprise, he believes it.
Right.
Hook, line, and sinker.
Debrinin says that's not happening. There are no offensive weapons. There will be no offensive weapons. We have no intention. This is strictly for the defense of Cuba, and therefore there's nothing on this island that can reach the United States of America, much less with a nuclear weapon. Forget about it.
And so Kennedy decides that he can tolerate the military buildup because he doesn't really want to have more trouble with Cuba. Okay, if it stays there and it's defensive and whatever, he has no intention of an invasion, so the weapons will not really come into play. Once he's convinced, because he wants to be convinced, that there's no offensive weapons, so he issues a written statement,
yep.
highly publicized and appreciated and noted in
published
Cuba
in the New York Times
and the Soviet Union. And I want to read two short excerpts from it. So he says, "There is no evidence of any organized combat force in Cuba from any Soviet bloc country. No evidence of military bases provided by Russia."
Sorry.
Oops.
These
yeah.
are all...
"No evidence of a violation of the 1934 treaty relating to Guantanamo. No evidence of the presence of offensive ground-to-ground missiles or of any other significant offensive capability either in Cuban hands or under Soviet direction and guidance." Now, here's the line to remember.
Here's the punchline.
"Were it to be otherwise, the gravest issues would arise." That what it means is, if you put them in, we will take them out.
That's right.
Don't do it.
That's right.
This is a line, a red line we're drawing. Do not cross it.
Now, it's worth asking what Kennedy thought that this would do. What would be the impact? It seems as if, based on all the intelligence that he's getting and all the political flack that he's getting, well, some of which is based on some sources that people had in Cuba amongst the exiles going back to Cuba, that his most earnest wish in life at this particular moment is that they don't put those nuclear weapons in Cuba. And so he said, if you do this, we'll have to take them out, essentially. But thinking or hoping or wishing or in a kind of semi-delusional way, thinking if I could, that they could just stop it right now. They'll just take it all the way up, 95%, 96%, 97% of all the military stuff they have. They want to give the Cubans, but they'll just stop just a little bit short and they won't put the missiles in. And then we can take a deep breath and sure, Cuba will have lots of weapons and have lots of Russians and all that stuff. But you know, we don't want to attack them anyway, and they say they're defensive, so okay, what the heck. Yeah.
Again, he has in his mind that Khrushchev has never placed missiles outside of the Soviet Union.
Well,
so
and
why
I also
do
don't
it?
Think that he could possibly imagine that a world leader could lie so many times to so many people so creatively.
At so many levels.
At so many levels.
And at the highest level.
And at the highest level.
The Debrinin and Bobby conversation is really, you know, very important.
I mean, this is
so
personally offensive.
Statement. He says, "It continues to be the policy of the United States that the Castro regime will not be allowed to export its aggressive purposes by force or the threat of force. it will be prevented, and I'm quoting here, by whatever means may be necessary from taking action against any part of the Western Hemisphere. So there is no ambiguity in Kennedy's statement. Now, he's doing this for a number of reasons. Again, he thinks that he's drawing a line in the sand that nobody's going to cross, but he's also making a very, very tough statement in reaction to his own hawks in the Democratic Party and the hawks in the Republican Party as the midterm elections are in the run-up stage. So this is a very direct statement. Now it's going to come back, as we know, to haunt him and to bite him.
What's going to happen is that once the missiles are discovered, all the hawks will be let loose at once, because Kennedy has now said publicly that they are unacceptable on the island of Cuba. Nuclear weapons are unacceptable. And they're going to quote his own words right back to his face and say, "Mr. President, if they're unacceptable, how are we going to take them out? We're going to take them out quickly. We're going to take them out now. And while we're at it, why don't we just send our troops in and clean out that mess, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera."
And by the way, they will not only quote his statements back to him chapter and verse, but they will wrap those statements up in a big, big bundle of "I told you so, Mr. President."
Yeah, this is not good preparation for the midterm elections.
This is a very interesting time. So what you can see is that basically now, with the Soviet denials, with Kennedy's statement, we are on the road to a collision that's going to happen in a month and change. So there we are.
They're going to be like two blind men running head on into each other, and each one's going to blame the other for getting in the way. That's it for this podcast. Visit us regularly for more in the podcast series, as well as news about our new book, short films, graphic novels, and, as always, by special arrangement, blogs by our three leaders. And don't forget to visit us at facebook.com/ArmageddonLetters. I'm Jim Blight.
And I'm Janet Lang. Take care.